Hello again, this is Gordon Karkner, Dr. Gordon Karkner, speaking to you about my book, The Great Escape from Nihilism. I want to give you a bit of the introduction and set the landscape, just the sort of terrain that we're covering and where we find ourselves in late modernity. In this discussion, we want to engage the ideology of nihilism. It has taken many people captive. Some are passive participants, while others are self-consciously involved in and have become active promoters of nihilism. It is related to how we approach the world and how we choose and how we perceive reality itself. The interrogation of this outlook promotes dialogue about some crucial issues in late modernity, our current situation at this stage of Western Enlightenment. Working diligently toward or together to decipher the code of nihilism, we will expose the ideology to critical examination, and we anticipate some pertinent discoveries. For this purpose, we have chosen Dr. Charles Taylor, eminent philosopher from McGill University, as our principal investigative assistant. As one of the great thinkers of our time, he will be of great help to move our discussion onto significantly higher ground. He is one of the top 12 living philosophers, the preeminent Canadian philosopher in political, cultural, and moral realm, and the premier philosopher of Western modernity. With his help, you might know Charles Taylor from his famous tome, A Secular Age, 2007. With his help, we hope that through discerning our location within Western culture, we can explore the claim that nihilism does not have the last word. What follows is a deep structure protest that there are broader horizons and layers of meaning to be explored, researched, and discovered. The journey ahead entails an archival rediscovery of our lost language, lost potential in relationship, lost perspectives on our lives. The discussion proceeds as a committed liberation project because many today long to escape the confines, addictions, and seductions of nihilism, the loss of meaning. The project is both a cultural probe and a quest. In his landmark book, A Secular Age, Taylor offers a monumental analysis of our philosophical and cultural climate, explaining how we have gotten here and where we might be headed. The stakes are high. He traces how we moved from theism through deism to atheism over 500 years, from the Middle Ages to the modern world, roughly between 1500 and 2000 CE. But in this substantial prize-winning tome, A Secular Age, he also explores how we can rethink and refresh the current debate about our identity and the nature of our secularity. Who indeed are we late moderns? What are the possibilities for dialogue between people of such divergent philosophical and ethical positions? How can we live and work together in a positive way? What are the interpretive keys for unlocking the mystery of our age, its spiritual and cultural imagination? Here's something, a quote from Taylor in this light. Our language, he says, has lost and needs to have restored its constitutive power. This means that we can deal instrumentally with realities around us, but their deeper meaning, the background in which they exist, the higher reality which finds expression in them, is ignored and often invisible to us. Our language has lost the power to name things in their embedding, their deeper, richer, and higher reality. The current incapacity of language is a crucial factor in our incapacity of seeing well and flourishing. Our language, our vision, and our lives often remain flattened in late modernity. More of this later. The discussion that follows in this book, The Great Escape from Nihilism, is an attempt to recover the richness of language and also the larger horizon of its meaning. In both The Secular Age, 2007, and his prior landmark discussion on philosophical anthropology, Sources of the Self, in 1989, Taylor documents a major change in the social imaginary, the way we see, feel, and decide on things. Our worldview is another way of putting that. That entails its interpretive background, ways things seem to make sense to us. One might also refer to it as the conditions of plausibility. How are things plausible for us? There has been a shift in ethos, one that includes people's basic sensibilities, their intimate assumptions, and perceptions about reality. So your social imaginary gives you your perception of reality itself. It's the way you see reality, sort of the set of glasses through which you look. Taylor strongly encourages us to learn from our historical roots. He says this, in quote, "Our past is sedimented in our present, and we are doomed to misidentify ourselves as long as we cannot do justice to where we come from. Our philosophical narrative is vital to our present-day self-understanding and problem-solving capacity." Taylor notes that human flourishing has become our main focus of life in a period of unbelief in the transcendent or the divine, that particular part of late modernity. We have moved from a transcendent to an immanent worldview since medieval times. In the West, God was once the ultimate good for the majority of citizens, and now human flourishing is the dominant good within what he refers to as the immanent frame or personal horizon. Every person in every society inescapably lives by some conception of human flourishing, that is, the fulfilled life, one worth living, one which we naturally admire. It is often inscribed in ancient moral codes, philosophical theories, or religious practices and devotion. So the definition and parameters of human flourishing encompasses yet another key concept in our quest to discern our age. Contrary to many, Taylor does not believe in the demise of religion in the post-secular age, but instead claims that we are in pursuit of more rather than less spirituality today. This reveals what he calls the Nova effect of multiple spiritual journeys or searches for meaning. So there's no question that in late modernity, even though we're in a crisis of meaning, everybody is in search of meaning in some capacity. We have not given up on spirituality and meaning. Late moderns are looking for it everywhere. They are bent on making sense of their existence, even in this age of nihilism. So that's part of the irony of our age. Taylor also speaks of multiple modernities because we actually experience modernity differently in different contexts and, I guess, among different tribes. We are cross-pressured. Perhaps this is why some authors like Walter Truett Anderson speak of people employing multiple selves as a coping mechanism, one for each environment. Late moderns are definitely on a search, and no one is quite sure where it will end. Perhaps a very popular Academy Award film, The Life of Pi, is a sample of the complexity and uncertainty of such a journey. The main character explores several religious and secular views to make sense of his adventure, and there are indeed many tensions between these viewpoints. He is quite conflicted as he tries to survive like many people today. The film's cult popularity shows significant cultural resonance with the ambivalence in the current late modern story. Now, Taylor notes that three main forms of spirituality or hypergood exist today: exclusive or scientific humanism, which is also seen as scientism; Christian or theistic humanism; and thirdly, Neo-Nietzschean anti-humanism, with its emphasis on exploring the full range of Dionysian appetites and desires, including cruelty. Some people also want to make or remake the human, as in transhumanism. through various forms of manipulation. Taylor focuses attention on the first three, feeling that the tripartite discussion is where we can find the greatest increase in understanding of our 21st century identity. The three visions are vital for the big picture discernment of the age we inhabit. Western modernities, in fact, are the fruit of new inventions, new stories, newly constructed self-understandings and related practices. They cannot be explained in terms of perennial features of human life. Some nominalists, like Michel Foucault, want nothing to do with anything essentialist called human nature per se. They are rooted in new forms of consciousness, a new sense of self, and a whole new world picture or outlook. The following 10 articles in this book, which include 10 moves, explore some of the important contours of this late modern consciousness. Perhaps you, the reader, will discover amidst the critique of nihilism a trajectory of retrieval of the good things repressed, some which were repressed or buried for centuries, things that are deeply relevant to our present and future. But first, we must understand some key components of nihilism, and included in this podcast, I'll talk about the immanent frame of Charles Taylor. So it's about secularity and the immanent frame. By mapping the terrain of our prison and beginning with the content, this content, we can perhaps find a way out of its existential grip. The immanent frame. In Charles Taylor, we are offered a particularly insightful analysis of our cultural ethos. He captures the way in which we have located ourselves in the late modern world, and the picture that has taken our minds captive, shaped our mind's eye. He identifies it as the immanent frame. This house of the mind and imagination constitutes a unique social imaginary in human history. Our focus at this point of the discussion will be to exposit the key insights of chapter 15 in his book, A Secular Age, called, in fact, The Immanent Frame. In this analysis, he shows how religion has been philosophically and culturally marginalized in the West, even while it is in resurgence by numbers, especially in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. Whether we do or do not value it, it is the Christian religion that has had the greatest shaping influence on Western culture, by many reputable accounts. As a plausibility structure, it has become marginalized and is often barely tolerated, and sometimes it is actually despised. One often notices hegemony against religion within academic circles, for example. Not exclusively there, but as one of the places where people feel marginalized as Christian believers. Taylor gives us tough insights and leads us to think freshly and circumspectly about how we have arrived at this cultural space and about the nature of our current and future options. The core theme of the book, A Secular Age, is to study the fate of religious faith in the strong sense in the West, meaning, first of all, belief in a transcendent reality, and secondly, the connected aspiration of personal transformation, which goes beyond, is greater than, ordinary human flourishing. Taylor calls into question the subtraction theory of the Western master narrative, the one most deeply embedded in our modern consciousness. This narrative, this meta-narrative, implies that science replaces religion after the breakup of Christendom. Within this faulty perspective, the growth of science entails the death of God and the recession of religion. In this case, religion is seen to be replaced by science. Taylor also asks some tough questions. Is this, in fact, hermeneutically valid? When did science become equivalent to secularism, and why? Where is the logic in this move? He reads this as a situation of fundamental contestability. Not certain at all, not final. Taylor calls into question the misperception of our Western history and our current reality, suggesting that it is wanting as a hermeneutical grid or interpretive schema. For example, top scholar Mark Taylor of Columbia University notes in his 2007 book, After God, that Western secularity is also a religious phenomenon in and of itself. For him, religion is not a separate domain, but instead pervades all culture and has important impact on every aspect of society. The simplistic notion that science has replaced religion, however popular, is extremely naive. In the face of this theory, the subtraction theory, or what Taylor calls secularity 2, he explores with reflective folks the plausibility of the life-nurturing transcendent dimensions of human culture. He does not believe that all citizens of late modernity need to deny the possibility of the transcendent from within the immanent frame. They need not live within a horizontal dimension only, which includes a flattened or thin form of language. From his perspective, the story of the rise of modern social spaces doesn't need to be given an anti-religious spin. The actual reality of Western culture is closer to the truth that, quote, a whole gamut of positions from the most militant atheism to the most orthodox traditional theisms passing through every possible position on the way are represented and defended somewhere in our society. They are defended in various non-neutral contexts, institutions, and communities. The actual situation, according to Taylor, is much more complex. This actuality creates for citizens of late modernity the sense of being cross-pressured by the different views, the plurality of positions that they encounter, making them uncomfortable at times with the tension. Citizens may indeed experience these different views in different spheres of their lives. Nevertheless, plurality has a way of teaching us and making us humble about our position, our own particular position. The dialogue and debate of these perceptions is still very robust, with endless potential options to find meaning. Both belief and unbelief in God coexist within society. And that's what Taylor claims is the secularity 3 position, the actual position that we're in. It's more a position of plurality of belief. He articulates a more inclusive and complex reading of late modernity than we often hear from other scholars, especially the new atheists. So what does Taylor mean by the term immanent frame? The buffered identity, as opposed to a porous pre-modern self, is a key part of such a mental frame. It operates within a disenchanted world where supernatural beings or forces with teleological goals or intentions are deemed close to impossible. Final causes or teleology are eliminated from one's whole world picture. With this immanent frame, there is a loss of cosmic order. Everything important is this worldly, explicable in its own terms. It fits in within the time-space energy-matter dimensions of a strictly material world. Social and political orders are constructed by humans solely for mutual benefit, not to please or resist a divine entity or conform to a transcendent good. Society is instead made up of atomistic individuals who collaborate as they see fit out of mutual self-interest. Each human is charged with finding her or his own way of being human, his or her own individual spiritual path, chosen or constructed from the options available within the nova effect phenomena in multiple spiritualities. Everyone has become their own measure of the good. They become autonomous. Consequently, their freedom to choose is a matter of primary concern, and they are ready to fight for the inviolability of their liberty, the liberty of their personal volition. To say that one more time, they are ready to fight for the inviolable liberty of personal volition. This is the emphasis on the will. You'll see this coming up again in late modernity. Nonetheless, the immanent frame perspective on reality is by no means ethically neutral or strictly objective. It includes some things, values such as secular time, and excludes others. It renders vertical or transcendent worlds as inaccessible or unthinkable. At the very least, irrelevant to serious thought and life. It takes a hard moral position, and as we will see in this next section, it operates as a philosophically reductionistic stance. The world is a leaner, smaller, less rich, and dimensional space. So that's a little bit on the landscape of the book, the landscape of late modernity and the immanent frame. Hope you have enjoyed this section. A lot to chew on and think about, and perhaps ask me some questions. Thanks very much. Gordon Karkner, The Great Escape from Nihilism.